density and the mass density are the two most highly fine-tuned parameters in all of physics, arguably in all of science, at least those that we can measure. This is where we find the most spectacular evidence for supernatural design. As you looked at some of our books, The Crater and the Cosmos in particular, the level of design we see in dark energy at a minimum is 10 to the 97 times, or 10 trillion, 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 trillion times superior to anything we human beings can manifest, even with all of our technology and government funding. This is the second release, and this is kind of overdue. Astronomers were expecting this to be released after the second year of data collection, but they waited until they had 3 years worth of data collection. They also waited until certain upgrades in the data analysis came through, and I think it was wise that they waited that long because now they have a sensitive enough signal to actually measure with some precision the polarization and the variations of the temperature of the cosmic background radiation. Now, to put this all in context, when I was at Caltech back in the old days, we had instruments that were demonstrating that this radiation was perfectly smooth. We could not detect any variations in that radiation above 1 part in 10,000. However, Big Bang cosmology demanded that there had to be at least some variation in the temperature of the cosmic background radiation. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any seeds that would lead to the formation of galaxies, stars, and planets. And so there was a lot of tension back in the 1990s. Would we find that it was perfectly smooth, in which case the Big Bang theory would be in huge trouble and the creation model would be in big trouble? Or would we indeed find temperature fluctuations at the level that the Big Bang would predict would lead to the production of galaxies, stars, and planets? And that's what happened with the COBE satellite results that came back in 1992. They found variations or fluctuations in the temperature of the cosmic background radiation at a level of about 1 part in 100,000 down to 1 part per million. But they wanted to, the whole basis of the WMAP was to test what subset of Big Bang creation models is correct. There are dozens of different Big Bang creation models. And this is the experiment that was geared to proving whether or not the inflationary hot Big Bang models are correct or the non-inflationary hot Big Bang models are correct. Now, the significant point there theologically is every inflationary hot Big Bang model would be compatible with what Bible authors have taught about the origin and history of the universe for the past 2,000 and 3,000 years. Keep in mind it was the Bible authors, 6 Bible authors, that taught the details of Big Bang cosmology long before 20th century astronomers came up with any inkling that we live in a universe with a transcendent causal beginning and a continuous expansion from that beginning. But in order to determine whether or not the inflationary hot Big Bang models are correct or the non-inflationary hot Big Bang models are correct, it was critical to pick up the polarization. And say, what on earth is polarization? Well, you've all probably worn these sunglasses, polarized sunglasses that you use for driving when the sun is low in the sky. And what it does is it filters out that part of the reflection of the sunlight off the pavement. And polarization basically measures the way that light differs in its properties as you see it from different directions. And so you can have your sunglasses polarized to receive light coming in like this or like this, for example. And that will help reduce the glare. And so this experiment was designed at measuring what's called the E and the B mode of the light. Now, the problem here is that the cosmic background radiation, even in the most optimistic of estimates of Big Bang cosmological models, the level of polarization is much less than the level of the variation in that light. And so it's necessary to make measurements to 1 part in 10 million, not 1 part in 100,000. 1 part in 100,000, you'll detect the biggest of the fluctuations. But if you want to see the polarization in those fluctuations, you need to have an instrument that's 100 times more sensitive. And this is the first time that astronomers have been able to produce an all-sky map of the polarization of the radiation left over from the creation event. Although they only got one of the modes. I'm trying to remember which one they got. They were measuring the B mode and the E mode, and I think they detected the B mode. The E mode is coming. Now, the difference there is the E mode would be a direct indicator of inflation. The B mode is only an indirect indicator of inflation. But it's a very good indicator in the sense that as you look at that B mode, it's going to behave in different ways at different resolutions, depending on whether or not the universe is inflationary or non-inflationary. And so the bottom line is that this second release of the WMAT for the first time has given us strong evidence. It's not explicit evidence, but it's strong implicit evidence. In fact, in looking at the data, I see no other way to interpret it other than that we live in a universe that is coming about as a result of an inflationary hot Big Bang creation event. But probably within another year or two, they'll have enough sensitivity to pick up the E mode, which would give us a direct detection of that inflation, and actually measure the inflation sensitively enough to tell us exactly which of the many inflationary hot Big Bang creation models is correct. But theologically, what has happened, maybe I'd better stop a minute and tell you what inflation is. Okay. The universe expands from a creation event. Big Bang cosmology tells us that there's an actual beginning of space, time, matter, and energy. And the beginning of the universe is a beginning where all the matter and energy is squished into an infinitesimal volume. So it's an infinitely small volume, and hence it's infinitely hot. But then it continuously expands from that infinitely hot, infinitely small volume to the conditions that it has today, where it's only about 3 degrees above absolute zero. The inflationary hot Big Bang creation models tell us that is when the universe expands from that creation event, it expands at about the rate that it does today, namely about 1 light year every year. It's expanding at almost the velocity of light. However, there's a very brief window of time, according to the inflationary hot Big Bang model, where the universe hyperinflates, where it inflates many, many times faster than the velocity of light. And this is predicted to take place when the unified field force becomes three forces of physics instead of two forces of physics. Okay. All right. Now, I think I can do this. Okay. Something you're all probably familiar with. You can take a bar magnet and you can heat it up above 600 degrees. And when that happens, the magnetism disappears. But it doesn't really disappear. What's happening is the heat energy and the magnetic energy blend together to become one energy source. And you can take that hot magnet and cool it below 600 degrees, and these two forms of energy will separate. The magnetism comes back. So that's an example where a unified source of energy will split and become two. And it's all temperature-based. Well, likewise, unified field theory is the concept that if the universe begins infinitely hot, there's only one force of physics. And as the universe cools, that single force of physics becomes two forces of physics, namely gravity and the strong electroweak force. And then a little bit later, that strong electroweak force splits and becomes the strong nuclear force and the electroweak force. And then finally, the electroweak force splits and becomes electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force. And that's the universe in which we live today, as four fundamental forces of physics. Now, the inflationary hot Big Bang models tell us that when the force, the strong electroweak force, which is basically three forces of physics, becomes two, the strong nuclear force and the electroweak force, when that happens, the universe hyperinflates. Also, when that happens, you get a bunch of defects in the universe. And you say, what are these defects? Well, again, let me give you an analogy. Think of a pond of water, and the temperature drops down to freezing, and that pond of water begins to freeze. Well, the freezing will first take place at the surface. And the thing you'll notice if you watch that pond carefully is it doesn't freeze all at once. What happens is you'll get these lines or points on the surface of that water where the ice forms first. And actually that ice will form in a higher density state. And then from those points and lines on the surface of the pond, you'll see that the freezing spreads out. So that's an example where when you get freezing, defects form. Those lines and points are called defects. While likewise, when the universe freezes out, in the sense where it goes from one force of physics to two forces of physics, three and four, you get freezing out. Now, I think it was, what, 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, I talked about the discovery of a cosmic string. A cosmic string is an example of a defect. So what we actually have, in the space of just 1 week, are two breakthrough discoveries in astrophysics that tell us that the unified field theory is right and that inflationary hot Big Bang models are right. Well, the good news about that for believers in Jesus Christ is precisely the unified field theory of physics and the inflationary hot Big Bang models that are most consistent with what the Bible teaches about the creation of the universe and its design so life would be possible. Yes. How long does the hyperinflation last? 10 to the minus 33 seconds. It takes place at that moment between 10 to the minus 34 seconds after the universe is created and 10 to the minus 33 seconds after the universe is created. And this is when the universe goes from being the size of an electron to the size of a golf ball. Okay, now that doesn't seem like much of a change in size, but when you consider how fast that it happens, that's many times faster than the velocity of light. Now, it is that period of inflation that allows the universe to be thermally in touch. I mean, one of the big problems of Big Bang cosmology in the past is how to explain how everything in the universe is thermally connected to one another. And that's when they came up with the idea of inflation. Hyperinflation is one way to speed the matter and energy in the universe in such a way that everything remains thermally in contact, which, by the way, is a critical feature for life to exist in the universe. If the universe is not thermally connected, then life is not possible. And this is one way you can make it thermally connected. So that was a theory that was proposed back in 1981, but not until a little more than a week ago did we have the observational evidence to prove that our inflationary unified field theories for the creation of the universe and the particles in the universe was correct. Yes. How do they relate to the Big Crunch theory? Well, the Big Crunch theory was eliminated when astronomers discovered that dark energy is a dominant component of the universe. And in fact, that's something else that's coming out of these WMAP results, as they're now going to have more accurate measures of the amount of dark energy in the universe, the amount of exotic matter in the universe, the amount of ordinary matter in the universe. And once again, those are the three constants of physics where we see the most spectacular evidence for supernatural design. Now, because the universe is dominated by dark energy, we know for certain it will never crunch. The universe will continue to expand until the Creator is done with it. And from a biblical perspective, that will happen when the Creator permanently removes evil from His creation. So once the conquest of evil is finished, this is when, from a biblical perspective, the universe will have fulfilled its purpose, and God replaces it with a brand new universe, the new creation we see in Revelation 21 and 22. But from a non-Christian perspective, dark energy guarantees that as we proceed into the future, the universe will expand faster and faster and faster. And therefore, there's no possibility that the universe will ever stop expanding and then collapse into a crunch and then expand again, which is very bad news for Buddhism and Hinduism. Buddhism and Hinduism is based on this concept of a reincarnating universe, where the universe has a beginning, grows from that beginning, collapses back down to a crunch, and then re-expands, and it's this infinite oscillation concept. So we want to know where the Hindus and the Buddhists and the New Agers get their idea that we human beings go through reincarnations. Well, it's fundamentally based on the concept that that's how the universe behaves. The universe reincarnates, so they claim we human beings likewise reincarnate. And Hinduism and Buddhism is far more detailed and specific on the reincarnation of the universe than it is the reincarnation of human beings. So the way I've always dealt with these kinds of people to say, if the Hindus and Buddhists and New Agers are wrong on something that they're very explicit and detailed about, why should we have any confidence to believe what they say about reincarnation, where it's much less specific and much less detailed? So, yes. Yeah. It's impossible for a material object to go faster than the speed of light in the absence of a dark energy term. Now, Einstein's theory of relativity was originally put forward without dark energy. You put dark energy into it, and things can easily go faster than the velocity of light. Now, dark energy is not the same as heat energy. Dark energy is the energy that's wrapped up in the surface of the universe. And there's nothing in the thermodynamics that would prevent that surface from expanding at any velocity it wants. By the way, that's why we can have this period of hyperinflation when the universe is 10 to the minus 34 seconds old, because at that point, you've got the surface expanding at many times the velocity of light. And when it expands at many times the velocity of light, it carries all the stuff that's on the surface with it. Again, keep in mind, the universe is like planet Earth. We human beings live on the two-dimensional surface of the three-dimensional Earth. So, for example, if you were to expand the surface of the Earth at many times greater than the velocity of light, and that would mean that New York and Tokyo would move away from one another at much more rapidly than the velocity of light. And that's what's going to happen in the future, is that the distant galaxies relative to us, because of the surface of the universe expanding greater than the velocity of light, will carry those distant objects away from us at greater than the velocity of light, and hence they'll become invisible to us. I mean, one of the things that we've been writing about in our books is the fact that this is the only moment in the history of the universe where you get to see the entire history of the universe. In the future, dark energy will expand the universe at such a rapid rate that these objects will no longer be visible to us. By the way, if we wait long enough, the surface of the universe will expand so fast that the sun will move away from us at greater than the velocity of light. And that means you look up at the night sky or the daytime, you'll see no light. It'll be pitch black because the light of the sun will never have an opportunity to reach us. Now, that's quite a ways into the future, so I wouldn't get too concerned about your investments in terms of what's going to happen with the sun, right? That would take care of global warming, right? Although before that event happens, Cliff, is the sun will hyper-expand and incinerate the Earth. So there is a real global warming problem to worry about roughly 4 billion years hence. So, pardon me? Freon's not going to help. No, that's not going to be any good. So, but no, it's exciting is the fact that in the space of about 10 days, we've had two very remarkable discoveries that basically eliminate these speculations about getting around the God of the Bible as the answer for the universe. The fact that we've established these hot Big Bang creation models means that these kinds of membrane speculations where they invoke extra large space dimensions as a way to avoid that inflation, they're gone. But those are also the speculations that were put forward to try to escape this causal agent beyond space and time. Yes. I'm not up to date on that, so that's a new release. I haven't heard about it. You've heard about it? Well, tell you what. I'll talk about that too, but we'll check out this Indonesian skeleton. Being Indonesia, I would guess it's either a Homo erectus or a Flores man. And so this would be a hominid species that would date quite a bit before the large-brained creatures. You know about it? Well, Indonesia has given us the richest trove of Homo erectus specimens. And these are the creatures that lived between 1.8 million and 200,000 years ago. They're about 5 feet tall, and their brain capacity is about half the size of ours. So you could refer to them as what? Half? Well, I better not use that. That's a bad joke. But they're missing the parietal lobe. Like all the bipedal primates, including Neanderthals and Homo sapiens like Deltu, regardless of how big their brains are, they're missing that critical parietal lobe that would support mathematics, meditation, philosophy, being able to participate in a class like this, and the language for that matter. So Neanderthal had a brain as big as ours, but was missing the parietal lobe, so he was not able to engage in the kind of technology or mental exercises that we're able to engage in. And by the way, the fact that his brain was as big as ours isn't really that significant when you consider that the Neanderthal was supporting a much bigger body mass. What really counts is how big your brain is relative to your body size, which might be of a comfort to all you women here in the audience. Women have smaller brains, significantly smaller brains than men, but notice they're just as smart as men. What counts is the size of your brain relative to your body size. And so women have a what they call an encephalization factor that's equivalent to that of men. And by the way, their parietal lobe is just as big and well-developed as it is for men. Although some say that it's used for different purposes. Yeah. Children wouldn't really be smarter than their parents? Well, not quite. It depends what kind of, what's developing. Well, for example, Neanderthal, even though he had a brain capacity of about 1,600 cubic centimeters, chances are a good chunk of that was devoted to supporting the nose, whereas almost none of our brain is used to support our nose. Well, I mean, the dogs that share your home, 40% of their brain power goes to support the nose. And Neanderthal may have been similar. Yeah, Jackie. Okay, what's been going on, Jackie, is that before we had this definitive evidence for inflationary hot Big Bang cosmology, there was speculation that maybe another way we can keep everything in the universe thermally connected together is rather than invoking hyperinflation, which would force everything to be in contact with one another, we can do it through additional dimensions of space. And by some of these models, they were able to introduce these additional dimensions of space. Another set of speculation was to say, well, maybe the constants of physics aren't constant, and they change radically over time. Now, the whole approach of these kinds of speculations was to see if they could get around the beginning of the universe and the design of the universe. Now, research has shown they're not able to get around the design by invoking variable physics, because when you invoke variable physics, you discover in order for the universe to support life, you have to fine-tune the variation. So what you can do is lower the design and the constants, but you increase the design and the critical amount of variation that's necessary. It's a classic example where an attempt to reduce design, they wind up increasing it in another area. It's simply a shell game. You're trading design in one area for design in another. There's none of these models are able to reduce the level of design in the universe. But some of the models are able to get around the beginning of the universe, this beginning of space and time. And this discovery of the WMAP basically closes the door on those speculations. Well, I don't think it's going to stop the research. I mean, there's a journal that you can get over at Caltech called Physics Letters B, and it's loaded with speculations about alternate cosmologies. And the people who write these papers often will freely admit in the introduction that this is pure speculation and has no bearing on reality. But they say, well, why do they bother to publish it? They publish it because it allows them to use some really exotic mathematics that they can't use anywhere else. And so it's basically an excuse to play with some really fun mathematics. But there are some from an atheistic perspective that try to claim that it's not just fun mathematics, it's a way we can get around this conclusion of the God of the Bible. But one paper that I do quote in several of my lectures is one by Ford and Roman in the Astrophysical Journal, where they commented that the ones that do successfully get around this Big Bang singularity, this beginning of space and time, all require that the universe not be subject to the second law of thermodynamics. And such a universe would not permit life to exist. And so they refer to those as unreasonable cosmological models, as contrasted with the reasonable cosmological models. And a quote I've used out of their paper is that all reasonable cosmological models are subject to the relentless grip of the space-time theorems of general relativity. And it's those space-time theorems that tell us there must be an actual beginning to space and time and a causal agent beyond space and time that creates the space-time matter and energy of this universe. So, but yeah, you can get around it if you're not willing to submit the universe to thermodynamics. But such a universe won't permit people to write articles in physics letter B. They won't permit their existence. Okay, you have one comment, then I'd like to get back to the lecture. This Planck. When the NASA put up the WMAP, there is a bunch of European astrophysicists that said, let's see if we can do one better than NASA, and that's Planck. Planck is a satellite that they're prepared to launch, I think in 2007, that will be even more sensitive than the WMAP. And it's so sensitive that it will probably be able to pick up gravity waves or the effect of gravity waves. So the next release of the WMAP should give us both the B and E modes of the polarization, which would give us both indirect and direct evidence for this inflation and tell us exactly what kind of inflationary hot Big Bang models. By the way, there's several dozen inflationary hot Big Bang models. All of them are consistent with what the Bible teaches on Big Bang cosmology, but it'd be nice to know which one. But Planck should be able to tell us what the gravity wave propagation is in the universe. And that's going to help us understand or interpret what the Bible says about the end of the universe. I think I've mentioned here before in the class that you've got these inflationary hot Big Bang models where the universe has a flat 10-dimensional geometry. But there's another set of inflationary hot Big Bang models where this flat 10-dimensional sheet closes in on itself and becomes a U, like that. In which case, you'd have a 10-dimensional sheet facing a 10-dimensional sheet. And if you put those sheets close enough together, therein there's a possibility that a space-time fluctuation on one sheet eventually, if you wait enough billions of years, will make contact with a space-time fluctuation on the opposite sheet. Now, for that to happen, the sheets have to be closer than a millimeter apart. So it's kind of hard to imagine that you've got this universe filled with stars and galaxies, and less than a millimeter away is a parallel universe. But these inflationary hot Big Bang models permit that possibility. And you say, what happens when the two quantum space-time fluctuations make contact with one another? Well, the entire space-time fabric of the universe disappears into a point, and it all burns up in a fiery blast, and the universe is gone. Well, there's three places in the Bible that actually make that kind of statement. 2 Peter, Revelation, and Isaiah. How God will wrap up the universe after he conquers evil, wrap it up like a scroll, and it'll all disappear in a fiery heat. On the other hand, you can argue that those passages are word pictures. They definitely are. They're metaphorical. The question is, how literally do you take the metaphor? Well, if you take it very literally, then it's these ekpyrotic inflationary hot Big Bang models. If you don't take it quite so literally, then it would fit these flat, 10-dimensional inflationary hot Big Bang models. So this is an example where advancing scientific research can help us determine which interpretation of the Bible is the best interpretation of the text. Only three verses, so it's not like you got a whole lot to work with. Okay, can we move on and talk about intelligent design? Let's do that. Pop this back up here. Here we go. By the way, I really appreciate the comments I got from you last week. I told several of you privately, not the class, that the reason why I'm going to be missing April 30th is I'm going to be flying up to Alaska to participate in a debate on intelligent design. It'll be the atheist Jerry Coyne, and then I'll represent the Christian perspective on intelligent design. Appreciate your prayers. They're only giving us 35 minutes each. And we thought, well, that's fine. We can have a Q&A afterwards. Well, no, the problem is we're doing this in front of a whole bunch of lawyers. thousands of lawyers are coming, and they want to be the ones involved in all the discussions. So they're going to ask Jerry Coyne and I to sit down, and they're going to discuss all this. So I appreciate your prayers for being able to pack into my 35 minutes when I need to pack in. And also, it'll be interesting to see how Jerry Coyne. Jerry Coyne is famous for releasing that statement from Richard Dawkins on why intelligent design is not science. And by the way, I agree considerably with the statement. Now, I will be back in town on the 30th, but what's happening is I'm going to be speaking up in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm going to take a red eye down to Fullerton. I'm going to participate in that all-day conference in Fullerton. And I figured I'm going to be wiped out, so I'm not going to try to do Sunday morning. I will do Monday evening, but not Sunday morning. And Jeff Zwierink, I've heard him do these skeptics forums before. He's outstanding. I think you'll really enjoy him. Appreciate your prayers for both events, the Fullerton event as well as the event in Alaska, both of them on this topic of intelligent design. Well, you know, where I agree with Jerry Coyne is in these criticisms of the intelligent design movement. Now, in going through these criticisms, I want to remind you that there's more than one kind of intelligent design. I told you that last week. This is not the intelligent design approach that we do at Reasons to Believe. The intelligent design movement is basically that group of Christians, and non-Christians for that matter, who are saying we need to knock down this giant of Darwinism. And how we're going to knock it down is we're all going to unite together, and we're not going to use a religious approach because they believe the Supreme Court has ruled against a religious approach, so that's why they don't identify the intelligent designer. And they also said we're not going to display our differences. We're going to simply agree that Darwinism is wrong and that naturalism is wrong. But consequently, they're stuck because they try to suppress all their differences, and they make it a point not to identify the intelligent designers, therefore they can't be charged as being religious. Then what they have to offer can't be tested or falsified. They basically don't offer any explanation for the origin and history of the universe or life, and therefore there's nothing that can be put to the test. You can't confirm it, you can't falsify it, it's not repeatable or observable. You have no significant predictions flowing out of it other than the fact that they're going to see these signatures for design. We don't see any refinement or improvement in their explanation, but probably the biggest criticism of all, and this is what gets Jerry Coyne really upset, but not just Jerry Coyne, virtually all non-Christian research scientists, is they see within the intelligent design movement a toleration of bad creation models. You probably heard that quote from Adrian Malott, the physicist at the University of Kansas. And by the way, Adrian Malott is the thesis supervisor for one of our volunteer apologists. So it's interesting, you've got this Christian and atheist working together. Adrian Malott is famous for the statement that intelligent design is creationism in a cheap tuxedo. And what's really disturbing to the scientific community is within the intelligent design movement, there is no clear disavowal of creationism. Now, when I use that term creationism, I don't mean people who believe in creation. The way the media defines creationism is the idea that the universe and everything in it has not been here for any longer than 10,000 years, more like 6,000. So we're talking about younger creationism. And you can understand why the scientific community is very nervous about intelligent design if they believe it's simply a cover for the young earth creationist model. Then the other thing that I mentioned last week is that non-Christian academics have a very negative view of us Christians, namely that they see us as simply being nothing more than evolution bashers. All we do is point out the flaws in the evolutionary paradigm. We don't stick our neck out and say what we think is right. And what the evolutionists are asking for is, show us your model. I mentioned last week that there was a primetime television debate back in 1998, four intelligent design proponents against four naturalists, and the four naturalists repeatedly said throughout that debate, where is your model? We have a model, where's your model? We're not interested in hearing all of your criticisms of evolution. We want to see what your explanation is and allow us to critique that and say, well, what on earth is a model? A model offers an explanation for the what, the where, and the when. Now, that's typically where scientists stop, but I've added a few things. a model, a scientific model, needs to offer an explanation not only for what happens, where it happens, and when it happens, but how it happens, the causes behind what happens, and most importantly, the why. Why would the record of nature look the way it does if your explanation for the phenomena is correct? So the cause and the why for a set of phenomena, and based on that explanation, predicts what researchers will discover in their future research. So in that sense, we need to recognize, evolutionists will not abandon their model, no matter how badly flawed, until they see a model with greater explanatory power and predictive success. I hear this on the campus all the time. I say, don't you Christians realize that we scientists already know that there are problems with our evolutionary models? But there's problems with all models. Nobody's got a perfect explanation of any phenomena within the record of nature. What we need to do is see from the Christians an explanation, a model that's better than our model. Then maybe we'll listen to what you've got to say. Now, I would argue these critics of intelligent design are wrong when they say intelligent design is not science. Why? Because I can name at least five different scientific disciplines where intelligent design is the core of that discipline and where this has been established for several decades. I won't go over this again. We discussed this last week. Archaeologists, of course, find these artifacts and try to determine whether the artifacts are caused by erosion, natural erosion, or by intelligent design. Likewise with forensics, they try to determine if a body that they discover is a result of a natural death or the result of murder or suicide. The anthropic principle, looking at these constants of the universe and trying to determine the degree to which they're fine-tuned. Now, one of the things you asked me last week is could I also provide some examples of failed intelligent design disciplines. I thought that was quite interesting, so I'm going to add this. I didn't discuss this last week. But these are some examples of intelligent design disciplines that I would argue are not successful. They're failing. The search for extraterrestrial intelligent life. They've been searching for decades, and they're not coming up with anything. Astrobiology. That's the science of life elsewhere in the universe, beyond planet Earth. It still ranks as a data-free discipline. And, you know, why should we be pouring money into something that has no data? Or the origin of life. Again, for 50 years, origin of life researchers have been trying to find a naturalistic explanation for life. If it's naturalistic, certain chemical pathways must be discovered. And as you see in our Origins of Life book, they're not being discovered either on Earth or anywhere else in the universe. But I'd also argue that the intelligent design movement's variation on intelligent design is a failed discipline. Now, what is it that makes for success and what is it that makes for failure? Well, those that are successful, they identify the designer. Mainly that's one of the problems with the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life, is they're not really being very specific about the nature of the intelligence behind these kinds of signals that they would be discovering. Where intelligent design is successful, they have detailed models, like in anthropology. They are able to identify a set of artifacts and say, these were created, designed by Neanderthals, or these were created by human beings. And so they're able to come up with a detailed explanation, and the explanations get better and better as the scientists learn more and more. Their explanations are eminently testable. They can be falsified or affirmed, and the predictions prove to be correct. And in this sense, what we're promoting at Reasons to Believe is not to abandon the big tent strategy of intelligent design. It was the lawyer, Philip Johnson, who came up with the idea that we need a big tent where all of us who believe in intelligent design unite together under the tent to argue against a naturalistic paradigm. And we're arguing that's a good idea, but it needs to be a big tent that practices free market competition. We've argued here before in a class that free market competition is an eminently Christian principle. You see it way back in the Genesis chapter 9, 10, and 11. And, Paul talked about it, how we're not to be going about destroying the temples of those who follow other gods, but recognize that Christianity favors best in a free market environment. And so the United States, for example, doesn't have laws that say if you're a Christian and you become a Muslim, you'll be put to death. whereas there are many Islamic nations where if you're a Muslim become a Christian, then you get the death penalty. In fact, that's taking place in the news right now. Free market competition, which means we need to have many intelligent design models, not just one or one explanation, and we want to foster the development of as many as possible. In that sense, we at Reasons to Believe don't want to have a monopoly on intelligent design. We're trying to encourage other Christians to develop models that will compete with our model. But we need to insist that all models be fully testable, falsifiable, and predictive. And on that basis, we need to be aggressive in developing short-range predictions, which is why you see in our books, for example, predictions of what we think scientists will discover 1 year from now or 2 years from now. And the principle there is after the book's been out for a year, the reader will know whether or not our explanation has merit or does not have merit. And we need to vigorously reject failed models. This is probably, as I mentioned, the biggest weakness of the intelligent design movement. And we need to refine the models that are successful. Our own model at Reasons to Believe has got a long ways to go in terms of being able to provide a better explanation than it provides right now. No model is perfect, no model is complete, but if it's a good model, then that means you've got grounds for trying to improve it. And then based on those successful models, to challenge the non-intelligent design models with contrasting predictions. It doesn't do any good to predict the same thing that the evolutionists predict. Like, for example, the sun will rise tomorrow. I mean, we both agree that the sun will rise tomorrow. What you need to do is come up with a prediction where you predict A and they predict the opposite of A. And then hopefully you wait a few weeks or a few months and you see whether A is true or anti-A is true. Now, one thing that I didn't cover last week, and this is something I'm going to be putting into my talk when I go up to Alaska, is science impotent? And what I'm going to do here is give you two sets of quotes. One set of quotes, and what I find interesting is this set of quotes comes exclusively from those who take a naturalistic or atheistic perspective. What they're trying to do is convince the public that science is impotent to deal with theological or religious issues. Probably the most common quote I hear from scientists and educators, public school educators, is that science can only investigate natural causes. Therefore, science must be taught from a strictly naturalistic perspective. Well, is science so weak that it can only investigate natural causes? Is that really true? Or to quote Eugenie Scott of the National Center for Science Education, and that is the organization that is the biggest organization in trying to attack creationism and intelligent design. And as she has said a number of times, no one has yet invented a theometer. And what she means by a theometer is a scientific instrument that could detect God. Well, I dispute that we have not yet invented a theometer. And the National Academy of Sciences came out with a document about a year ago in which together they said science can know nothing about the supernatural. Left a word out there. Science can know nothing about the supernatural. Is science really that weak? In fact, I'm arguing that because of comments like this, the public is getting disinterested in science. You know, the United States right now faces a really severe science education crisis. We're seeing declining enrollment in science across the land. Now, one reason why we haven't paid too much attention to it is we've made up for the lack of students taking science here in America by bringing them in from overseas. And so in many university campuses, half or more of the science student body will be made up of foreigners, not Native Americans. In fact, it's such today that South Korea graduates more engineers and scientists than the United States does, with 1/6 the population. And I think one of the reasons why we're seeing this very rapid drop in science enrollment is that we're teaching our students at an early age that science is not very effective. It's impotent to deal with these kinds of issues. Whereas I can remember being taught science during the Sputnik era when people thought science could do anything it wanted to. because science is viewed as very exciting. And but now we're trying to, with comments like this, I'm arguing, we're basically communicating to our students, you know, science is weak, it's boring, it's for nerds. Well, who's going to be enrolling in science? Okay. However, now these are Americans that are making these kinds of statements. What I find ironic is you've got this atheist astrophysicist in the People's Republic of China, and he wrote this long before Tiananmen Square. And by the way, Fong Liji is arguably the most famous scientist in the People's Republic of China, although he's no longer living there. Why? Because he was probably the most prominent leader at Tiananmen Square. And when that happened, the Chinese government exiled him. So he's now at the University of Arizona in the astronomy department there. But he's still an atheist. But while he was in China, he wrote a book on cosmology where he said, quote, a question that has always been considered a topic of metaphysics or theology, the creation of the universe, has now become an idea of active research in physics. And so what you have is this atheist, a scientist in the People's Republic of China, saying science is powerful. It's not impotent. It has the power to directly investigate these issues of metaphysics and theology. I think you've heard me give these quotes before. This is from three American atheists, two from Stanford and one from MIT, which they talk about dark energy. And they wrote this paper a couple years ago where they said, if dark energy exists, then arranging the universe as we think it is arranged would have required a miracle. Now, what that implies is, if dark energy is real, we can prove a miracle. If dark energy is not real, there is no miracle. And by the way, Dyson, Kleban, and Susskind closed their paper off by saying, dark energy must be wrong. Dark energy must be wrong, because if it's right, we're stuck with this miracle. And by the way, they said this as well in the same paper. An external agent, external to space and time, intervened in cosmic history for reasons of its own. Again, based on the reality of dark energy. And they, by the way, they titled their paper, The Disturbing Implications of a Cosmological Constant, which is another name for dark energy. And they wound up concluding that this is so utterly disturbing that there's this external agent performing miracles for reasons of its own, dark energy has got to be wrong. But as I've mentioned here in the class before, that paper was posted on the Los Alamos website of preprints just weeks before astronomers came up with really compelling evidence that dark energy is indeed real. By the way, the WMAP has given us the most accurate measurement of dark energy to date. 74% of all the stuff of the universe is dark energy. It's not only real, it's the dominant component of the universe. Yes. Well, what happened is it was posted on August 1st of the year 2002 in this form. And several of the colleagues of Dyson, Kleban, and Susskind came to them and said, you know, we don't think this dark energy is wrong. You better get those statements out of the paper. And so they wound up rewriting their preprint where they took this stuff out. However, they still closed the paper off by saying dark energy has got to be wrong. So that's kind of the history of what happened. Fortunately, I was able to get a copy of that August 1st initial posting on the Los Alamos website. I've got the August 1st version as well as the August 14th version. But, yeah, they were convinced dark energy had to be wrong. And now, what do you do with it? There's no question that dark energy is real. And then we got this statement from Paul Davies. This goes all the way back to 1986 in his book, The Cosmic Blueprint. And he wrote this as an agnostic. He's still an agnostic. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers. The impression of design is overwhelming. Now, I've read his book. He talks about only 14 or 15 design features of the universe. And based on those 14 or 15, he said, the impression of design is overwhelming because of how carefully you have to fine-tune those 14 or 15 characteristics of the universe in order to make any kind of life possible anytime, anywhere in the universe. And by the way, the latest that you'll see up on our website is 86 characteristics. I think we're the only ones that ever try to make an attempt to be exhaustive in looking at all this design evidence in the universe. But this is an excellent example of where astrophysical research is able to directly investigate whether or not there is a designer and what the qualities of that designer would be. Now, whenever I presented this in front of audiences filled with atheist research scientists, they always come back by saying, well, wait a minute, science is not as powerful as you think it is, because science cannot prove anything in an absolute sense. And you know, they're right. Science, for example, cannot prove in an absolute sense that Jesus is a designer. But it can establish that Jesus is a designer, plus or minus a measured degree of uncertainty. And that is a limitation of science. Science cannot prove anything with a zero uncertainty. The whole question, though, is there reaches a point where the uncertainty gets small enough that we're able to act upon that very tiny uncertainty. And all of us make decisions like that. I joked last week that I told my wife, Kathy, on the day we got married, that I was marrying her with less than absolute evidence of her existence. All I had was a high probability. But, you know, I've been married to her for 28 years now, and I can tell you, based on certain experiments I've been performing, that that probability is much higher than it was on the day that we were married. On the other hand, the day we got married, the probability was so extremely high that there was no doubt in my mind that she really existed and that she was worth spending the rest of my life with. So, and what we're really doing here is challenging the skeptic who says, I won't believe until I see absolute proof. And by the way, this isn't simply academic. I once gave a lecture in front of an audience called Atheists United. There were 300 of them in the audience. And at one point in the evening, I asked the question, how many of you would be willing to give your life to Jesus Christ if you saw adequate scientific evidence that indeed Jesus Christ is the creator of the universe? And about two-thirds of them put up their hands. And I said, well, how many of you would be unwilling to consider the truth claims of Jesus Christ on your life, even if the evidence were, as great as it possibly could be? And what they said is, unless we see absolute proof, we're not going to believe. We demand absolute proof. Well, that one-third, I mean, if they're being consistent with their life, they shouldn't get up out of bed in the morning. It's too risky to get up out of bed, given all the uncertainties that exist in life. So who knows whether if you get up in bed, you're not going to have a heart attack right away and collapse. Or who knows whether or not the second law of thermodynamics will wipe you out. And there is a small probability that'll happen. Okay. Well, as I mentioned last week, when we say Jesus equals the designer plus or minus a measured uncertainty, that's always done in terms of a ratio. What is the effect and what's the error bar in that effect? And yeah, I've got an example of that, but you know what? I've discovered I'm running out of time here. So I'm going to have to pick this up next week. But let me kind of take you ahead to where I think we can make some progress on that. Oh, boy, this is going to be fun. We're going to talk about how to do SETI the wrong way and how to do SETI the right way. So come next week, and I'm arguing that spending Paul Allen's billions of dollars and the U.S. taxpayers' money to build a huge array of telescopes and over detecting a signal from extraterrestrial intelligent life is an example of a bad way to do intelligent design. And we'll contrast that with a good way to do intelligent design. But let me get to your question here. If Christ is a designer, we would expect that the more we learn about the universe, the more evidence we would find for supernatural design. And if there is no supernatural designer, we would expect that evidence would get smaller. And so I'll go into this next week, but here's an example of the evidence for the supernatural design of the solar system that we'd accumulated through a survey of the literature completed in May of 2002, where we determined that the probability that you're going to find a planet or a moon that can support life without invoking divine miracles is less than one chance in 10 to the 217. But if we jump ahead just 30 months, that probability is less than one chance in 10 to the 410. So it shows you that in 30 months of research, the evidence has gotten, well, about a million times stronger every month. Every month, the evidence that Christ is the designer of the solar system for the benefit of life gets a million times stronger, which means if you wait 2 months, it becomes a trillion times stronger. And if you wait 3 months, it becomes a quillion times stronger. So And it's been that way for quite a few decades now. The evidence has been exponentially getting stronger and stronger. So yeah, next week I'll give you two examples of how to do intelligent design the wrong way and how to do it the right way in terms of these critiques. I was hoping to finish this week, but I didn't do it. But hey, the WMAP was fun. So, and I'm predicting that probably this cosmic string discovery in the WMAP will wind up ranking as the two top breakthrough discoveries in science for the year 2006, and that we're only 3 months into the year. It's hard for me to imagine anything more significant than that being discovered this year. So a great time to be alive. Father in heaven, it is a good time to be alive when so much is being discovered. And Lord, we thank you for all the scientists that are out there doing research. And Father, I want to pray too for the science education crisis, that we who are part of the body of Christ and the church will begin to communicate to our children and to our youth, both in the church and outside the church, that you've given us two revelations, two books, the Bible and the record of nature, the book of nature. And Father, may we be active in stimulating our young people to consider the power of this record of nature to reveal your handiwork, and the power of the record of nature to put to the test different philosophical and theological beliefs. And Father, may that lead to people being excited and thrilled about scientific advance. And Father, may we, especially in the church, not be timid about exercising the study of both of your books for the furthering of the evidence for your existence and of your plan of salvation for all of us. I pray for each one of us in this class, Lord, that you would give us specific opportunities within these next 7 days to have contact with people that don't yet know you as Lord and Savior, and be able to use these new reasons to believe in you as a bridge to share with them the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.